I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. The weeks between Happy Thanksgiving and Happy New Year are a hectic time as we make our lists and buy presents for friends and family. There are also parties to attend and celebrations of good cheer. It's supposed to be a happy time of year, but not everyone feels it. That got us thinking about what happiness is, what happiness isn't, and what makes people happy. And we have two guests who have joined us, including Cassie Mulginer. She's here with us in our Philadelphia studios, and she's an assistant professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where she studies happiness and time. And Cassie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here. I think we're going to play this tune throughout the hour. Joining us from California is Sonia Lubomirsky. She's a professor of psychology at the University of California at Riverside, author of The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy, What Doesn't, and What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. And Sonia Lubomirsky, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, let me begin with a really boring question. I'll put this first to you, Sonia, because I think we need to define our terms here. What do you mean by happiness?
Sure thing. Great question. Well, I define happiness the way that researchers tend to define it, which is that essentially happiness is two components. And the first component is a sense that your life is good, that your life is going well, you're progressing towards your life goals. And the second component is the experience of positive emotions, joy, tranquility, curiosity, affection, pride, etc. So you sort of both need that, you know, emotional part and also that sort of cognitive part where you sort of you're satisfied with your life.
Do people sometimes confuse that with pleasure, you know, feeling that happiness is that sort of momentary feeling of pleasure?
Right, they do. Well, you know, pleasure has negative connotations, but really when we're talking about pleasure, we're talking about positive emotions. And,
right.
And so momentary positive emotions are actually important. You know, when you're feeling good or joyful just for the moment, you might be more creative. Your immune function might improve. You might make a new friend. So I think we shouldn't kind of denigrate, you know, momentary happiness.
You also, and then I'll get to you, Cassie, you also talk about the importance of being grateful, that's also sort of part of happiness. And this
that's
is to you,
right.
And
so
this is to you, Sonia.
Yes.
Oh. No, that's to you, Sonia.
Yes, thank you. My lab has done actually quite a few what we call happiness interventions, where we ask people to try different strategies and we follow them up and to see if they actually make people happier. And gratitude is one of the sort of practices that we study, and there's now lots of research on it. People who try to be grateful by either counting their blessings or writing gratitude letters to people in their life, they become happier. There are all kinds of sort of good things come. Their relationships improve. It's really a very powerful, I think, an important sort of practice to incorporate into your life.
I mean, there's a kind of humility that goes with being grateful, too. It's not like I deserve
absolutely.
Whatever
yeah,
I have.
Totally. And in fact, one of my former students who's in Philadelphia right now as a postdoc did a study with some collaborators where we showed that people who write gratitude letters actually feel more humble, and then feeling humble makes you feel more grateful. So the idea is that when you realize that your success and your happiness isn't only due to you, it's also, you know, due to a lot of people in your life who've helped you, that you're sort of standing on the shoulders of giants, that makes you feel a little bit more humble.
Cassie, let me get you in on the conversation. And you study happiness and time. Help us understand the connection between the two for you.
Yeah, so the reason I started looking at time is because for me that is the resource that is phenomenally constrained. It's sort of in juxtaposition to a lot of the work that has been done within happiness and looking at the role of resources, which has largely focused on the role of money. And so, as I mentioned, even as a grad student, where both time and money were constrained,
nice.
I felt that time was more meaningful to me and more reflective of who I am. And so I started to investigate what's the role of time and money. And instead of looking at the effect of having each of these resources, I looked at the effect, I would sort of argue a broader effect of merely focusing on or thinking about these two resources on happiness. And what I have found is that people who focus on time or situations that lead one to focus on time as opposed to money leads to happier behaviors and leads people to feel happier.
Give us an example of what you mean.
Yeah. So, for example, in a study, I was looking at if I, as an experimenter, just led people to think about time versus money. And the way that I did that was have people do a sentence unscramble task and sort of unbeknownst to the participant, either time-related words or money-related words were in that task, so leading them to think about time or money without them necessarily knowing it. And then I wanted to see how does that influence their behavior. And this is resting on previous research that tracked how people spend their days and finding that, you know, over the course of their activities, not only are do sort of 19 activities comprise people most people's days, but they also tracked how people felt while engaging in those activities, finding that the activities that were associated with greatest happiness were interpersonally connecting activities. Huh. So spending time with friends and family, intimacy, and the activities that were associated with the least amount of happiness were work and commuting. And so I wanted to see if I led people to think about time or money, how does that influence their tendency to behave in either these socially connecting, as in happy ways, or these sort of more professionally driven endeavors. And so in one study, actually, I wanted to look in a context where people both socially connect as well as work. And so being at a university that happens to be a cafe. And so you see people, of course, you know, hanging out with their friends,
sure,
being on their phone. You see people with their books open or computers open doing work. So as they were entering the cafe, I had research assistants have them do this sentence unscramble task. And then unbeknownst to the participants, we observed how they spent their time in the cafe. And also when they were leaving the cafe, we conducted another survey basically asking how happy and satisfied they felt. And what we found was that those who were led to think about time going into the cafe spent more time at the cafe, talking with other people in line, talking on the phone with friends, you know, chatting with the barista, whereas those who were led to think about money on their way into the cafe actually right. spent a greater proportion of their time, you know, with their noses buried in books. Those who left the cafe having spent more time socializing were happier than those who had left the cafe having spent more time working.
Can we extrapolate from that that if you feel like you actually have time on your hands to do with as you wish, then you feel happier about your life or feel happier about engaging with others?
No, I would actually suggest that irrespective of how much time you have, the way you spend time is what matters for happiness. Mm. And in particular, spending time with others, even if you're feeling time constrained, I actually think that that is something to keep in mind, that oftentimes when we're feeling pinched for time, we become very selfish in our time and very sort of self-focused in what will sort of be good for us. You know, the workaholics out there are often pinched for time. And what my research suggests that if they, instead of focusing on that sort of resource of money, right. if they were to shift their attention to time, then they will spend that time in happier ways.
So, Neil, let me go back to you. And I'm just curious mm-hmm. about when you ask people about whether they're happy or not. And that's such a subjective question. How do you mm-hmm. frame it or what are the various questions you do to try to get to whether someone truly is happy, even by your definition?
Sure, sure. And it's a really good question because it's not that easy to measure happiness, but it's definitely very feasible. My approach is that, you know, happiness is very subjective. You know, only you know how happy you truly are. I would say that it's possible to have a disease and not know you have it, but you can't be happy or unhappy and not know it. So self-report is really the gold standard, sort of asking people how happy you are. So there are quite a few reliable and valid measures or scales where people are asked, you know, on a scale of 1 to 7, you know, how satisfied are you with your life? How often have you experienced the following emotions, say in the last 2 weeks? So again, mostly we ask people, but there's other kinds of measurements as well. You can code people's facial expressions. You can ask, you know, their partners or friends how happy they are. But as I said, the gold standard is really just to ask in a variety of questions about people's emotions and happiness and life satisfaction.
And does it make sense to you, what Cassie was talking about, her research on time and happiness, does it make sense to you that there is some kind of correlation there?
Yeah, absolutely. She's obviously, there was a really cool study that Cassie did. That was obviously about kind of transient happiness, how people were feeling at that moment. So I would love to sort of extend that work to kind of happiness over a period of time. So for example, working, of course, makes people happy over the long term. And social relationships are really critical to happiness as well. Sort of what is sort of the tension between spending time on, socializing versus work kind of over, not like right now today, but kind of over the next 5-10 years. I think I would love to sort of do more studies in that. But it absolutely makes sense. Lots and lots of research shows that social relationships are really critical to happiness and maybe the most critical factor in happiness. Although there's one meta-analysis that my colleagues and I did where we actually found somewhat stronger correlations between happiness and work variables, anything to do with work, because we spend so many hours of our lives working as well. So they're clearly they're both critical.
Cassie, you've also looked at happiness as people age. And is there, as people get older, is there a different definition of what happiness is?
Yeah. So we have found, and this is, I definitely agree with Sonia, that there is this distinction between that sort of fleeting feeling happy in your life compared to sort of this longer lasting feeling happy, reflective, feeling satisfied about your life. In the work that we looked at, the sort of shifting meaning of happiness over the course of life, we're specifically focused on this sort of feeling positive in the moment. And what we found was, I think, very interesting, that amongst younger people, happiness is more closely associated with feeling excited. As people get older, it becomes more closely associated with feeling calm and peaceful. And our initial sort of observation of this was looking at what people write that they feel in blog, in their blogs. And so basically, one of my collaborators created this web crawler that crawls the blogosphere and captures anytime someone writes, "I feel" or "I'm feeling," it captures what they're expressing, that emotional expression. And so we focus on when they said, "I feel" or "I'm feeling happy," what are they communicating? And so that's where we saw that there are really these sort of two primary types of happiness, one associated with feeling excited, one calm. And we saw by looking at the blogger's profile information that the age of the blogger influenced their likelihood of expressing one type of happiness versus the other.
We need to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about happiness in this hour of Radio Times. Doesn't get much better than that. Talking with Cassie McGillner, sorry about that. Cassie McGillner, she's an assistant professor of marketing at the Wharton School, studies happiness and time. Sonia Lubomirsky, she's a professor of psychology at University of California at Riverside, author of The Myths of Happiness. We want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. As we all know, the hectic holiday season is upon us, and we are busy making lists. We're buying presents, and that got us thinking about, does stuff bring us lasting joy? Does money matter? Does money make us happy? Does time make us happy? Talking with Cassie Mulginner and Sonia Lubomirsky, and we're looking for your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Sonia, going back to you and picking up on what Cassie said right before the break about how different ages view happiness, the idea that if you're younger, happiness is more associated with excitement. As you get older, more peaceful. Again, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I love that finding. I remember reading about it. And I think it's consistent with some other work showing that as people grow older, they really do change in sort of how they spend more time. They become, in a sense, emotionally wiser. They're not seeking, young people kind of seek novelty, stimulation, meeting new people, a lot of variety. Older people tend to sort of stick with, meeting, if they have a choice between, having lunch with their sibling or having lunch with a new, you know, a totally new friend. They choose the sibling. They're kind of, their emotions are a little bit more on the low arousal side. And it's also, interestingly, kind of consistent with some research that shows cross-cultural differences in the kinds of emotions that people prefer to experience. So it turns out that, you know, people in Asian cultures, for example, are they prefer to experience emotions that are more low arousal, like tranquility and calmness, whereas, say, Americans and people in Western cultures prefer to experience sort of enthusiasm and excitement. So that's sort of really interesting as well.
And the kind of high stimulation. You've kind of looked at that, Cassie, which is these extraordinary versus ordinary experiences.
Yeah, so we were interested in whether people extract greater happiness or what types of experiences elicit greater happiness. Because, you know, if you're looking even just amongst happy experiences, you see this wide range. Some people will talk about their amazing vacations. Some people will talk about the fact that, you know, they just had, you know, got married or had their first grandchild. While others might mention, you know, enjoying a lovely moment with a friend or enjoying that glass of wine at the end of the day or that piece of chocolate. And so we were sort of interested in, is it the extraordinary or the ordinary that elicit greater happiness? And again, we found age to play a big role here. So what we found was that among younger people, it is those extraordinary events, those life milestones, those once-in-a-lifetime vacations that elicit greater happiness. Now, if you look amongst older people, those extraordinary events still produce happiness, but ordinary events produce as much happiness. So if we're looking at the happiness that people enjoy from ordinary events, you see that there's increasing enjoyment as people get older. And it really seems to be partly, well, age is a good proxy for it, but it's really about how much time people feel like they have left and therefore the preciousness of their time. And so as people feel like their time is more limited and more precious, then these ordinary simple moments produce incredible amounts of happiness.
Which makes a lot of sense. Sonia, I think we all know people who just seem happier than other people. And one wonders whether it's, you know, some kind of biological basis. They'll look at a situation and see the goodness, even if what everyone else sees is the badness.
That's right. So, you know, when we look around ourselves, we see some people are just happier than others. I mean, that's a pretty common observation. And, you know, research shows that there's lots of sort of factors that determine sort of why some people are happier than others. You know, one is genetics. Happiness has a fairly large genetic component, you know. So identical twins, for example, are much more similar in their happiness levels than our fraternal twins. Now, it doesn't mean that we're sort of fated to be happy or unhappy based on our genes. We certainly, there's a lot we can do to change our happiness levels by the ways that we sort of behave and the ways that we think. And our life circumstances does also influence our happiness, you know, how much money we have and how healthy we are and whether we're married or divorced, et cetera. So those factors do play a role. You know, the makes some people kind of see the glasses half full and half empty. But I guess the bottom line from my research and a lot of people's research is that despite sort of those things, you know, there are ways that we can increase happiness by kind of intentionally and deliberately kind of practicing certain kinds of strategies, you know, like spending more time with people or focusing on our goals or being more grateful or being more optimistic or trying to be more forgiving.
Including sort of talking to oneself that way? I mean, that sort of cognitive approach?
You mean like the sort of
a self-talk.
I'm a good person?
Well, or some version of that.
Well, you know, there's some research that shows that can work at least in the moment. And then there's some studies actually that show that sometimes it makes you feel even worse.
Oh, really?
Okay. I'm not sure. I think the research is mixed on that. My takeaway from sort of all the research that I've read and that my lab has done is that it depends on the person. You know, maybe for some people it works to sit in front of a mirror and say, you know, I'm a good person. You know, I'm smart.
Right.
I know. But I think for most people that probably is not the case. But, you know, you have to kind of choose what's right for you. For some people, really focusing on what they appreciate, what they're grateful in their life, that's going to be the key practice for them. For other people, it's improving their relationships. For other people, it's really focusing on their goals and trying to work, you know, in a more productive way. So it's going to really depend on the person.
Are you a happy person, Sonia?
I am. I'm not like super happy, but I would say I'm kind of moderately happy.
How about for you, Cassie?
I would probably be described as a super happy person.
Oh, really? Okay. And what's your secret?
Well, I think that fortunately, as Sonia said, some of it is genetic. I think I was lucky enough to be born as with a very fairly positive set point. But then I think that, as Sonia mentioned, there's things that we can do and ways that we can think that can lead even people who are perhaps more sort of glass half empty type folks to think more like someone who tends to be glass half full. And so that's where, in my research, I actually love Sonia's model, where she talks about these different determinants of happiness, because I very much sort of center my work in this notion that there are things that we can do. There are ways that we can think that can increase our happiness, even if it's happiness in a moment, that I think is fairly powerful and motivating.
Well, give us one example.
Well, touching back to my research before, I think that thinking about time rather than money. Also, even I would suggest that giving time, spending time on other people, is a sort of helpful way to be happy. And it's actually, we sort of position this work, and it turns out to be fairly counterintuitive. So as I mentioned before, a lot of people feel very time constrained, more so today than in the past. And oftentimes when people feel time constrained, they become stingy with their time. And what we found was, if instead of being stingy with your time, if you give some of your time away, spend it on others, then you actually feel like you have more time.
Yeah, interesting.
You feel less stressed out.
Very paradoxical.
It's even so, we found that compared to wasting time, even spending time on yourself, even getting a windfall of time, that if you give 10 minutes, 30 minutes to help someone else, then it actually makes you feel very effective. Like, you can do a lot with your time, and that translates into feeling like you have a lot of time, reducing the pressures and stress of not having a lot of time.
We're talking about time. We're talking about happiness. Talking with Casey Mogilner, assistant professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies time and happiness. Also with us, Sonia Lubomirsky, a professor of psychology at the University of California at Riverside, author of a book called The Myths of Happiness. And again, we want to hear from you. Happy or not? That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Both of you have mentioned money, and I do want to get into money and happiness. And if I can start with you, Sonia, and I you know, you just wonder whether I'm not talking about being rich, but being sort of secure and financially secure, whether those people are happier than people who are poor, where your life is full of stresses, full of worries about paying bills, all sorts of questions about, can you feed your family, things like that. Can you speak to that, Sonia?
Sure. Actually, I get asked this question so often that I wrote this like little section in my new book, The Myths of Happiness, kind of what's the bottom line on money and happiness? And the bottom line is that people with more money are happier. I mean, they absolutely are happier. But they're not sort of as happier as you think they'd be, so you think they'd be like super happy, but they're not. And it also depends how you measure happiness. People with more money who are more financially comfortable are more satisfied with their lives. It doesn't mean that they're happier minute to minute, because they actually tend to be busier and they tend to have more stress. And what's really key, and there's a new book called, or fairly new book called Happy Money that talks a lot about this, is what's really key is, what you spend your money on. If you spend your money on large objects that you possess in your home, that's going to not make you very happy. But if you spend your money on, helping others, giving to others, giving to society, or spending money, on doing things with your family and your friends, or growing as a person, taking cooking lessons or traveling or taking your nephew to a baseball game, those are things that's how money really does contribute to happiness.
Let me follow up, and then I'll get to you, Cassie. But let's say, buying a work of art. I mean, it doesn't have to be a Picasso or something like that. Sometimes buying a pair of shoes makes me really happy. I'll just be completely honest with you.
Yeah, great point. Well, the thing about shoes is that, people who like to buy shoes, they have a lot of shoes, right? Because they buy a pair of shoes, and that gives them a great boost. And then they're like, oh, but I really want these other shoes, right? So they adapt. And I do research on what's called hedonic adaptation, where you sort of adapt or get used to what you have, and then you want more, and then you want more, and then you want more. That is not such a good thing. A work of art actually, you know, is an object, it is a material possession, but it also gives you an experience, right? So I think there's certain things like, you know, your smartphone or work of art that are both sort of material possessions and they're experience makers. So that I would sort of not put them into either category.
Let me get you back in on the conversation, Cassie. So how do you see then money and happiness?
So very similar to what Sonia was saying, that certainly if you – people who don't have enough money to sort of cover their basic needs or to feel that sense of financial security, it does have a negative impact on people's not only daily well-being but also life satisfaction. Yeah. And there's a lot of work that, you know, addresses this question. A lot of the conclusions are sort of vary. The work that I actually see as sort of being the most compelling of late is an article from 2010 by Kahneman and Deaton, where they looked at, they basically found that over $75,000 a year, having more money doesn't translate into feeling happier over the course of your day. Now, still over $75,000 a year, a sort of logarithmic effect of money, not absolute effect of money, does continue to translate into greater life satisfaction. And so I sort of take this to suggest that once you've sort of covered your basic needs, having more money doesn't translate into feeling happy over the course of your day as much as you think it would. We have some recent work that I think is fairly interesting where we asked thousands of people, which would you prefer, having more money or more time? And what we found was that people who said that they would prefer to have more time were happier. We also saw that people's likelihood of expressing wanting more money or time was influenced by age. As people got older, they were more likely to say they wanted more time. Most people, however, said they wanted more money. 70% of people said they wanted more money. And controlling for how much money they have, both by income as well as how wealthy they feel, as well as how much time they have, whether they are working, whether they have kids to take care of, as well as how much time they feel, controlling for those who wanted more time were happier than those who wanted more money.
There is this phrase, Schadenfreude, to you, Sonia, where you get sort of happiness out of other people's misery. Can we factor that in on our conversation?
Sure. You know, that doesn't make you happy. It doesn't make you happy to focus on sort of how much better you are than other people. And, you know, a long, long time ago, when I was a graduate student, I did my dissertation on social comparison, sort of whether comparing yourself to others makes you happy or is related to happiness. And I found that it doesn't. You know, I actually was kind of naive at the time. I thought, well, happy people, they compare themselves to people who are worse off, right? And that makes them feel better, whereas unhappy people compare themselves to those who are better off because that makes them feel worse. And actually, it turns out to be completely false. It turns out to be that people who are happy don't tend to compare themselves to others at all. I mean, they can't fail to notice, you know, others who are suffering or who make more money or are more beautiful than they are. But it just doesn't affect their sort of self-esteem and their mood as much. So, yeah, so Schadenfreude is a really poor prescription for happiness.
Indeed. We have an email from Bob. He says, having recently gone through a divorce and now having lots of time on my hands, I find inactivity breeds unhappiness in me. I am happy when I'm busy. You're nodding your head, Cassie.
Yeah, so this is going back to one of your questions at the beginning. Is it that having more time makes you happier? And I would say no. What I would say is that the ways that you spend your time is what determines how happy you feel. And so I would encourage this gentleman who emailed in to structure his day in such a way that he is spending time in ways that are fulfilling, that he is exposing himself to new experiences, that he is getting out there and spending time with people. And hopefully that will sort of help him in this transition state.
We have another email. This is from Larry. How can anyone who keeps up with the world news be happy today? I should add that we talked about the torture report in the first hour of Radio Times today. He goes on to say, if we count our own blessings, many of us think of the millions of people in the world who are in very bad situations, and then we feel guilty of reveling in our own commitment to our personal lives. This is where it gets complicated, Sonia, which is how do you stay happy in the face of the sort of misery of the world? And now that we can know what's happening all around the world, how do we live with that knowledge?
Right. A couple of responses to that. I mean, one is, there are multiple kind of approaches or perspectives on the world. You know, you can sort of focus on all the terrible things that are happening. You can focus on the wonderful things that are happening. And sort of it's your choice, in a sense, to kind of what perspective you put in front of you. So that's kind of like the glass half full, glass half empty response. But my other response, actually, I think is even more important, which is that I don't think that happiness is at all sort of inconsistent with, you know, caring about, you know, the bad stuff that's happening and then doing something about it. The research actually suggests that it's the happy people, the happier, more grateful people who are more likely to kind of get off the couch and do something. And when you're sort of wallowing in like, oh, everything's so horrible and my life is horrible and there's all this horrible events happening in the world, you know, you tend to kind of feel you don't do anything. You know, you sort of lose motivation, you're lethargic, you get depressed, you don't have much energy. And it's the people who are sort of more inspired and motivated. They're grateful for their own life, which makes them inspired to sort of help others. So I don't think that happiness and kind of, contributing to society or trying to change the world to be a better place are at all inconsistent.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Sonia Lubomirsky. She's professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. She studies happiness, in fact, is the author of a book called The Myths of Happiness. Cassie Mogilner, I don't know why I'm having trouble saying her name. Cassie Mogilner, assistant professor of marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies happiness and time, aging and happiness. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Cassie Mogilner and Sonia Lubomirsky, and we are talking about happiness, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We did want to do this show because this is the happy season or supposedly happy season, and a lot of people, I get great pleasure buying gifts for friends and family and thinking about that. Can you speak about the sort of happy presents that we might think about, Cassie?
Yeah, so there's a whole sort of body of literature that looks at gift giving and what are the better gifts to give. And I have some recent work sort of touching again to that comparison that we made before between buying experiences versus buying material goods. And what we looked at was whether giving experiences, such as, you know, taking someone out to dinner, buying them tickets to a concert, you know, getting them golf lessons or, you know, treating them to a wine tasting versus what most people tend to give in the holiday season, clothing, mm-hmm. electronics, jewelry.
Toys.
Toys, exactly. And so what we were looking at, what's the effect on the relationship from the gift recipient's perspective? How close do they feel to the person who gave them the gift? And what we found was that people who received an experience felt closer to the gift giver than people who received a material gift.
Is that because you think, you know, Cassie really likes golf? You've had to think about them in a slightly different way.
Yeah, so they are perhaps more thoughtful, but that doesn't seem to be what's driving the effect. And also what doesn't seem to be driving the effect, which you might expect, is spending more time with the person. Because what we found was that giving an receiving an experience, whether it was consumed with the person, so whether they took me out to dinner or whether they gave me a gift certificate for that dinner, shows the positive effect. So the thing that seems to be driving it is the sort of intensity of the emotion that is evoked when you're consuming the gift. So when I am enjoying eating that dinner at that concert versus when I'm wearing that sweater or, wearing that piece of jewelry, it's the emotion that is very important within relationships, and that translates into a better gift.
What if I knitted you that sweater?
Right. There certainly are material gifts that have this sort of emotional component to them. Certainly, you know, a sweater that you knit for me, I would love. You know, my engagement ring is also sort of tied to an experience. So there are, again, these material possessions that do have this emotional component, but oftentimes they don't. And oftentimes people adapt to them very quickly.
Sonia, anything you want to add to that?
Not really, but I think that, yeah, I think Cassie summarized that work and the implications really, really well, that sort of the more of the of an experiential component there is, the more we enjoy it, the less we adapt. You know, the more it, I think anything that, that sort of can contribute to social interaction, you know, gifts that we can enjoy, you know, with someone else, with friends, and that can enhance our relationships, which has been found to be related to happiness.
Sonia, I have an email for you from Diane. Has your research shown that people with pets take to take care of are prone to be happier?
You know, I don't know.
Do you know?
I don't know any of any studies. Maybe Cassie does. I mean, I do know that there's some, sometimes pets are used for therapy or social support, and not a lot of research in this area. Maybe someone can do a dissertation.
Well, this is worth nothing. It's just based on my own experience. But animals or dogs in this particular, they get you out of the house. I mean, if you're going to be walking,
right,
you're going to see people, you're going to talk to your neighbors, all of that. I mean, the kind of things that both of you have been talking about.
Yeah, and while I similarly don't know of any research that has looked specifically at having pets, given the work that shows that loneliness is one of the biggest contributors to unhappiness, and the fact that having a pet creates a form of companionship, and as you noted, getting outside, like we live near the dog park, and I feel like that is the most social place in the city, again, sort of fostering not only the relationship with the pet, but also with your neighbors, I could only imagine that it would have positive effects.
Let me get Chantel from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Chantel, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Chantel? No, we don't. Well, let me read what it says. She's been meditating, and she's noticed a great increase in her happiness. She's also found that hope is important. Sonia, can you speak to that? We didn't really talk about meditating, but is there a connection between that and happiness?
Sure. Lots of studies, lots of experiments have shown that people who are prompted or, you know, asked to, say, learn to meditate or engage in a multi-week kind of meditation practice program show benefits, you know, well-being, you know, either even, you know, I saw a study where students' grades go up, you know, when they learn to meditate. So, yeah, I've never done it myself, but, you know, I everything I read and hear is that meditation is really beneficial.
Yeah. And I would think also picking up on the time research that you've done, Cassie, is that with meditation, I mean, you do sort of carve out some time for yourself away from the hubbub of your life.
Yeah. And also one of the benefits of meditating with respect to time is it increases people's focus and appreciation of the present moment, drawing their attention to the here and now, which increases savoring, increases appreciation, as opposed to a wandering mind has been showed to in sort of hurt happiness. If people are sort of anxious about the future or sort of living in the past, that, again, this is actually with respect to that sort of feeling of happiness in the present moment, but thinking about the present moment is a big contributor of that.
Let me get Dan from Collingswood, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Piggybacking on the study of the relationship of money to happiness, I was wondering if your guest has studied the relationship of debt to happiness, and I can take my response off the air.
Have you looked at that, Sonia?
I have not personally looked at that. But there's some work showing that the more debt, not surprisingly, you know, debt is related to unhappiness. So I feel like I'm saying the obvious, but yeah, yes, that's definitely been found.
Yeah, I mean that would make sense because you sort of feel as if I'm looking at you, Cassie. You sort of feel as if you're not in control of your life. You're worried about paying off the debts, the future, all the things that we've been talking about.
Right, and the level of anxiety that's associated with that. And so sort of going back to what we were saying before is once – if you're out of debt and once you can sort of cover your basic needs, then money is less important for your daily happiness, but you need to pass that threshold for it not to matter.
So, if I may jump in again, psychologists have shown that, you know, basically bad things are more powerful than good things are good. You know, so like finding $100 on the street is not as is nice, but, you know, losing $100 is even worse. Uh-huh. And so debt is that negative, you know, so having debt is much more, you know, unhappiness inducing, I guess, than not having debt is, if that makes sense.
It does. Back to you, Sonia. I mean, when you study people who are truly happy or happy people, how much time do they think about how happy they are?
Not that much. Actually, one of my favorite surveys showed that Americans think about happiness at least once a day.
Oh, really?
And so your listeners would definitely fall in that category today. So I think people, you know, in certain cultures we sort of can't help but, I don't know, sort of think about it. But it turns out that thinking about your own happiness too much is detrimental. It's kind of like when you're trying to lose weight and you don't want to weigh yourself all the time, or you don't want to check your stocks, you know, all day long, you know, because, you know, your happiness is going to go up and down. And so monitoring happiness is not a great thing. You know, you want to do it once in a while to kind of check in. Gee, you know, maybe I should change, you know, how I think, how I behave, you know, once in a while. But, you know, it's not beneficial to monitor your happiness too often.
Well, we are allowed to pursue happiness in this country. Let me get to, looks like Deirdre from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Deirdre. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have two questions. Feel free to answer just one of them.
Okay.
I'll try to make it quick. One is the word joy and comparing that to happiness and whether or not you think it's the same or distinguishable. And then related to that, my question was spirituality. And that is a component of either happiness or joy.
About joy and happiness. Can I toss that back to you, Sonia?
Sure. Joy, I think, is more of a, you know, positive emotion. It's defined as researchers tend to define it as a positive emotion. So it's one component of happiness. Happiness is more of the kind of the larger construct, you know, kind of like a meta construct. So we're happy when we experience, you know, various positive emotions, including joy, including curiosity, including pride, including tranquility. So joy is sort of one of those emotions. It's not necessary. You know, some people, you know, prefer the low arousal emotions, as we talked about before. In terms of spirituality, that's a great question. Quite a few correlational studies have shown that people who are more spiritual and people who are more religious tend to be happier. I mean, that's a pretty robust correlation. The question really is why. And, you know, the answers tend to be that one is that more spiritual, more religious people tend to have sort of stronger communities, friendships, families. You know, if you're part of a, you know, religious network or group or church, mosque, synagogue, that contributes to happiness. And also more spiritual and more religious people say that they have more purpose or meaning in life, and that helps them, for example, to cope with adversity. And so it doesn't mean that you have to be spiritual to sort of have meaning and to have a strong community, but it certainly helps.
Going back to you, Cassie, we were talking earlier about gift giving, but I'm also thinking that this is often a time of year that people make donations. Do you think are happier people more charitable than others?
So people who, talking about the book that Sonia mentioned before, Happy Money, the big finding there was people who spend money on other people enjoy greater happiness than those who spend that amount of money on themselves. And so that's sort of suggesting another causal direction than you suggested, which is basically if you are to spend money on others, if you're going to give to charity, you will feel happier than if you were to spend that money perhaps on your pair of shoes. Or for me to spend on shoes. You love spending on shoes.
I do. Confession. Sonia, anything you want to add to that?
And, you know, basically the same thing that, you know, lots of studies now are showing that if you help others, you know, almost anything, it doesn't have to be monetarily, you know, you could give time, you can help in other ways. If you do acts of kindness, if you're generous to others, not only does that benefit the recipient, but it benefits you maybe even more. We did a study at a company at Coca-Cola in Madrid where we asked some of the employees to be givers and sort of to do nice things to their colleagues, and actually the givers benefited more than did the receivers. And so absolutely, this is all consistent with sort of this idea that, that giving money away is going to make you even happier than sort of keeping it for yourself.
We have a comment from Ryan. He says, what about new programs in big companies to try to promote happiness through optimism and resiliency training? Have you looked at that, Cassie?
I haven't, but Marty Seligman is doing at the University of Pennsylvania. He's sort of considered the father of positive psychology. He's doing a lot of work in that, looking at the role of resiliency both within companies and also within the military. And it's from what I gather of the work is that it is very effective and very important for tenure at the company or in the organization, and also productivity.
And productivity as well. Sonia, I'm thinking about happy employees or happy workplaces. Is it taking the things that we've been talking about and just using them or figuring out how to apply them at work?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. You know, almost everything we're talking about will be relevant to the workplace as well. My laboratory has been doing quite a few studies in workplaces. I already mentioned the Coca-Cola study. We did a study in Hitachi in Tokyo where we're kind of prompting employees at these companies to practice various strategies, whether they involve kindness or gratitude or optimism, you know, kind of on a regular basis to improve their productivity, to improve their sort of morale, their work satisfaction, and their life satisfaction. And it does work. I mean, it's not easy, you know, because you have to kind of want to do it. You know, I think that's one of the problems with these kinds of big programs at companies is that, you know, if like the president sort of says everyone should be doing this, people might not respond so positively. So they really need to convince people that this is going to work and this is really good for them. It's not just sort of good for the company's bottom line, but it's good for them. So I think if you're motivated and you think that you care and you think this is going to be sort of beneficial for you, that it can be quite powerful.
And we're almost out of time here. Are happier people at the workplace more productive, Cassie?
Yeah, there is some work that suggests that, and in particular, feeling happy in the workplace. And I would argue that given that we spend so much time at work, we want people to be happy, that is a worthy end in and of itself. But also the extent to which people are happy at the workplace and feel like their work has meaning has a big impact on, again, how long they will stay within the organization and how productive they will be within the organization. So it benefits both the employee as well as the employers to foster happiness and meaning.
And meaning is mm-hmm. in many ways the operative word, right? Finding that meaning in that thing that you do every day.
Right.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Cassie Mogilner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies happiness and time. Sonia Lubomirsky, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. She's a professor of psychology at the University of California at Riverside, author of a book called The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy, What Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does, and both guests joining us in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens with Quinn Lipson. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Pharrell.